Back together again, you and I wrapping up a holiday-shortened week, Friday, September 5th, 2025, on Connecticut Today, where I opened the show and we talked about the state of Connecticut possibly buying a minority stake in the WNBA's Connecticut Sun to prevent the team from maybe relocating to another market. Also, we welcome Republican State Senate Leader Steve Harding for his thoughts on that possible stake in the Sun and where the money may come from. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso dropped by with his weekly wrap-up. We also welcomed Alice Lovejoy, the author of Tales of Militant Chemistry, The Film Factory in a Century of War. All right, so let's set the table for this, all right? Now, we know that we've been talking for days and days and maybe a few months here now that the state's only major league sports franchise, not the state's only professional sports franchise. There are several pro sports franchises in this state. The AHL teams in Bridgeport and Hartford, the AA baseball team, the Hartford Yard Goats, the AA level soccer team that plays in the stadium right off 91, right before the Colt building there in Hartford. Those are professional teams. The WNBA's Connecticut Sun is a professional major league team. Major leagues in this country and in this state referring to the NBA, the WNBA, the NHL, Major League Baseball, the NFL, and Major League Soccer. So you have basically six major league teams now. Major leagues, Connecticut only has one team, despite being a pretty large ad market or television market. Now, we'll get into that later. But besides being a decent-sized state, a relatively compacted, easy-to-travel roads, well, easy is a relative thing, but you're talking about 3.5 million people here in a pretty easy area most days to navigate here. We only have one team in one of these six, quote-unquote, major leagues. That team may be leaving. And a lot of you that have talked to me in the past, and I was been through this with the Whalers back 30, 40 years ago, whatever, and a lot of people that I speak to, both, you know, here at Connoisseur, just kind of taking the temperature of the building, and people I talk to and communicate with online said, I couldn't care less if they leave. Go ahead. We shouldn't be financing any state partnership or state takeover team. Or should we? And therefore, that is what I begin with today right here on this Friday on WICC 600 AM, 95.9 FM, and of course online, voiceofct.com. Should the state buy a minority stake, which is what is being discussed here? Now, who knows where the money would come from? These plans are all kind of murky here. They're kind of foggy. Our buddy, our pal, Steve Harding, state Republican Senate leader, he's going to come on with us later on in the 4 o'clock hour to maybe shed some light here as to where this money would come from. Would it come from an investment fund the state has? I don't know. Who would watch this investment? Would it be the state treasurer or the state comptroller? Would it be Sean Scanlon, friend of the radio station here recently on this program? Would it be Eric Russell, the state treasurer? I don't know. So from a constitutional standpoint, there'd be some things to work out. Now, again, the team is valued, or for what the Mohican tribe says, they have seen the team valued and they've received bids or offers that the league is looking at now to sell the team for upwards of $350 million. Not too shabby, considering they bought the Orlando Dream for $10 million. So back in 2003, so roughly you're looking at a 22-year return on the investment from $10 million to about $350 million. Not too shabby. Most investors would take that. But is it the, and I know people were a lot of people wanted to do this back to keep the Whale in Hartford, you know, back 30 years ago or so. And a lot of people said, no blanking way. The state should not be in the business of pro sports, or should it be? I want to float something to you here in a moment, which may change your thinking on this or not. But if you want to get in line here, talk or text, you know the number on a Friday. A lot coming up on the show today. Busy show, but we start out with this. at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And I'll let you know what I think. Not that people are hanging on edge as to what I think, but what I do have for you is a proposal to look at this in a different way. Because immediately people, and this is the response I've gotten to the question here on our Facebook page, immediately people look at this and say, no way, no way. All right. So I ask you, and I'll come back with maybe a different way of thinking of this. Should the state buy a minority stake, and that's important, they're not looking to buy the whole thing from what we've been told. Should the state of Connecticut, or as our esteemed dear departed governor Bill O'Neill used to say, as one word, the state of Connecticut. Should the state of Connecticut buy a minority stake in the Connecticut Sun to keep the team from moving to another city? Because, after all, where would you rather set down your roots and play professional basketball, Uncasville or Boston? I give you that choice. But in all seriousness, we'll get back to this momentarily. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, as we stroll along. It's a Friday on Connecticut Today. And we ask this to get you and I going here on this Friday, September 5th, 2025. Should the state of Connecticut, yes, where you and I guess, most of us who are listening now, ostensibly live, but you folks listening out of state, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Should the state of Connecticut buy what they're terming a minority stake, which means less than 50%, which means they would not be the majority owner. And the Connecticut Sun is valued at $350 million. So should the state buy a minority stake in the Connecticut Sun in order to keep the team from moving to another city? Now, I guess the thinking is that if the Mohegan Tribe brings in another part of the ownership group, be it the state and state government, which would be, I guess, and who knows how this fund would work, would be headed by the governor, I don't know, with, I guess, some purvey from the state comptroller, Sean Scanlon, from the state treasurer, Eric Russell, or whatever, maybe legislative leaders, who knows? But would that make it tougher for the WNBA and ipso facto by default the NBA from uprooting the team? Now, I know what a lot of you folks are thinking. Well, it's a sports team. It's a private enterprise. All right. I get that. Hear me out on this. And I'm not taking one side or the other on this, but I'm presenting it to you. You tell me at 333-9422. We'll talk to Steve Harding from the Republican State Senate Caucus coming up on this in the 4 o'clock hour. But think about this. You and I, all the time we do these shows, I talk about it. Lisa talks about it on her show. Melissa talks about it on her fabulous program. We hear about the state giving out grants, tax deals, state funding. The state is giving so-and-so developer, or the state is doing tax incentives in the single millions or tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, whatever. The state is always looking to partner with people. Are they not? Or is it not? Do we not hear of these stories all the time where the state of Connecticut, and by extension, you and I as taxpayers, that we have some sort of, I don't know, connected ownership stake in something the state of Connecticut is doing, ostensibly with state-level funding, meaning tax money? Oh, we got a major company to come here, or we helped out this developer, or the state is teaming up with the feds, or the regional this, or the local conclave of this. In other words, the state all the time, we talk about it 24/7, 365 on this radio station, all year, every week, every day, about the state getting in bed financially. Now, let's not go to the gutter there. But the state cohabitating with people on some sort of a business deal. All right. Some of them work out spectacularly. Some of them are train wrecks. Some of them are eh. Some of them, the state makes a little money. Some of them, they don't. Some of them, you know, 10 years down the road, people look at it and like, what in the heck were you thinking? So how is this any different? And I know the temptation is to say, well, So the state should not get involved in a private sports franchise. Well, okay, and to which I ask you again on the flip side here, once again, how often does the state rhetorically get in bed with some sort of a private entity? Happens a lot, more times than you'd think. So what's wrong with that? Shouldn't the state, or I should ask, what's wrong, if you will, with the state perhaps investing in something that would generate traffic to get people into an area like downtown Hartford, right? Listen, the UConn women play a lot of games in downtown Hartford. The UConn men play a lot of games in downtown Hartford. And I know what you're saying. Well, Paul, that's not a, that's UConn. That's a, yeah, but the state doesn't fund UConn. UConn gets, what, $1 billion a year, or 1.1 or 1.2 billion or whatever that is? So the state doesn't fund UConn? You see, there's a connection there. Even though you don't want to see it here and talk about it, there is. A piece of your tax revenue, my tax revenue, the business next door's tax revenue, whatever, a piece of all that is ending up at UConn, and that's supporting UConn, and they bring their men's and women's national championship level basketball teams into whatever the building is going to be called in downtown Hartford. I still call it the Civic Center. That's how old I am. So what might be the problem? Or do you find a problem? Or are you all for this? Now, am I all for this? I'm not sure. You say, well, what do you think, Paul? I don't know. I got to see the deal. Nobody seems to know what the money would be here. But here's the question. If we know that, say, the WNBA's Connecticut Sun playing the Indiana Fever with Caitlin Clark, right? If we know that that game at the arena in downtown Hartford is going to draw 14, 15,000, 16,000 people, bringing in all those people ostensibly driving into Hartford, looking to pay to park, some looking to have hotel rooms, maybe the teams having hotel rooms there. A lot of people, as I say, the old Whalers thing, Chuck's Steakhouse, having dinner before or after the game, going to the clubs, resuscitating Hartford after everybody runs and gets the hell out at 5 o'clock, unless there's a UConn game or a concert. You know what I'm talking about here. So is that okay? Because think about it. You can say, well, I don't want my tax money doing this. Well, your tax money's already doing it. Whether it's a direct investment in UConn, whether it's a state getting into a fiscal partnership with a lot of companies, small and big. You don't think this happens all the time? I think people just naturally recoil at this because they say, well, it's basketball. The state shouldn't be in the basketball business. Okay, well, guess what? They already are. Talk to Gino Auriemma. Talk to Coach Hurley. Talk to Jim Calhoun. You set up a very nice you set up a very nice retirement fund for Jim Calhoun, in case you don't know. So once again, I will ask you, should the state buy a minority stake? So again, remember, if the team is valued at $350 million, that means a minority stake is probably something less than $175 million, being a little less than 50%, 49.999% and below. Should the state buy a minority stake in the WNBA's Connecticut Sun to keep it here, to keep the team here, to keep the team playing games, both at Mohegan Sun and at the arena being renovated in Hartford? All right, so when we hear about state investments or the state partnering with a private venture, whatever it is, we need to know details, because invariably state money, quote unquote, unless it comes from the feds, is kind of our money, sort of, in a roundabout way it all is. So what is up with these rumblings of the state trying to maybe do a partnership with the Connecticut Sun, buying a stake? How much of a stake? How would this work? And where would the money come from? Is this from an investment pool that we use? Who knows? Republican State Senate Minority Leader, Republican Leader Steve Harding joins us to maybe fill us in. Steve, good afternoon, sir. Happy Friday. How are you?
Same to you, my friend. And Paul, always good to be on your station and talk to you and talk to your listeners. So thanks for having me on.
And thank you, Steve. So I don't know, do you guys and gals on either side of the General Assembly aisle, do you know any more about this? Because, Steve, frankly, you can imagine I have listeners here who may love the Connecticut Sun. They love women's basketball.
Right.
And they're saying, hey, wait a minute here. So what have you been able to glean besides these kind of cryptic reports over the last couple of days?
Well, I think that's part of the problem here. And I think one of the reasons why we absolutely need more details and some sort of public hearing, because obviously in one form or another, state funds or taxpayer funds are going to be used on this deal. If we're investing as a state any sort of money, obviously the taxpayer funds are going to be part of that. Mm-hmm. Obviously the state, the governor's office and you know, Department of Economic Development, whoever else in the state, obviously can work with private investors to add to their investment in the team. But ultimately, in the end, if the state is going to be putting up money, it's very obvious it's going to be taxpayer funds.
Mm-hmm.
And automatically, I'm going to have reservations when you hear taxpayer funds. The latest that I've heard is probably very similar to the latest that you've heard and your listeners have heard, which is essentially a match or even exceeding what reportedly the WNBA has offered for the team, which I think is around $250 million. And the reports that I've seen or the information that I've been given indicates that the state would be putting up, you know, upwards of about $100 million towards this investment. And you know, it's interesting because you continuously hear Democrats sprint to a microphone every time there's a threatened or rumored federal cut for $1 million here or there. As this devastating potential cut, yet when it comes down to us coming up with $100 million to keep a sports team, it's readily available to us. It is a little odd and hypocritical, I would think, at least when you look at it from that lens. But with that said, I understand both sides. I understand that some of the listeners that call up and say, look, this is a big economic boom, particularly to the eastern end of the state of Connecticut. It's important to have a high-level professional sports team in the state because, unfortunately, when the Patriots, you know, were rumored to come and backed out, then obviously we at one time the Hartford Whalers.
Mm-hmm.
It is nice to continuously have a WNBA team, but when you're using taxpayer funds, there has to be extreme and high levels of transparency at the very least.
Yeah, and I guess, Steve, part of the thinking here, too, is, and you mentioned, of course, the Whalers days and the NHL days. And, you know, I'm old enough to remember I used to go to maybe 5 or 10 games a year there. And listen, when the Whalers were home, Steve, on a Friday night or Saturday or Monday or Tuesday in Hartford, people actually stayed in Hartford. People actually came downtown. They parked. They spent money. They ate before, during, and after the game. So I guess, Steve, there is, as long as the numbers shake out, and you guys and gals haven't seen the numbers yet, but there are some situations where maybe it's an economic stimulus, especially with the arena getting this makeover again, well over $100 million. But I would imagine that's, you know, we got to see a study on that or something, don't we?
Well, you hit the nail on the head, and that's the reason why I'm asking, and I think many of my Senate Republican colleagues will be doing the same, is calling on the governor's office, the Department of Economic Development in the state, to have a public hearing on this before anything is negotiated or finalized, at the very least, because the residents of the state deserve to know where their taxpayer money is going, and they deserve to see the numbers. To your point, if you can show that the economic gain that we receive based upon retaining this team at Mohegan, or even negotiating something where they play a certain amount of their games at the Excel Center in Hartford as well. I'd heard some reports that they may even, you know, have some games in Bridgeport down at the arena down there potentially as well. I mean, so these are all different options. And if you can show us the numbers and show that an investment, a long-term investment in keeping this team here is worthwhile to our economy in the state, then maybe it is an investment that's worth doing with taxpayer funds. But we need to see the numbers first. We can't go into this blindly. As I mentioned before, it's hard-earned taxpayer money. It needs to be treated with the level of respect it deserves. And I'm not liking the lack of information we're getting right now, albeit it could be because there's a lot of closed-door negotiations. It may be confidential. There may be some things that we can't discuss. But the one thing that we need to know for a fact is that before anything is signed on a dotted line and the state of Connecticut commits any level of taxpayer funds towards this deal, there needs to be full transparency, and the public needs to be provided answers, numbers, and provided an ability to have input in this before we use any taxpayer funds.
Republican State Senate Leader Steve Harding. Steve, finally, I'm wondering, and that's why I wanted to have you on today, because you see the budget as a lot of your co-legislators do up there. Where is the money for this? Is there a dedicated fund, Steve, for public-private investments? Could the money legally come out of the, say, the rainy day fund or the budget surplus? Where do you, and I won't hold you to anything, but okay, let's do this. Okay, and what line in the budget, Steve, does this come from? Do we know?
Right. I mean, I would highly doubt there's $100 million in a line item that's related to this. There could be some level of funds related to economic development investment that's in the budget, but it can't possibly be to the level of $100 million. So my guess would be there might be something in the budget using the operational funds that gets us to a certain point within where to get to this $100 million. But my guess would be that the residual amount would likely come from bonding because the governor does have some wiggle room there, does have some space underneath the bonding cap to invest. And so my best guess would be it would likely come from bonding expenditures.
Very interesting. Steve Harding, Republican State Senate Leader. Steve, thank you for the insight, my friend. Have a good weekend, and we'll talk down
Always
the road.
Great, Paul. You enjoy your weekend.
Thanks,
thank you,
Steve. Appreciate it. Well, there you go, folks. Well, right around every week at this time, we'll bring him on a little early today because there is stuff to talk about. Former Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso joins us with his ideas and thoughts on all things Bridgeport, because Chris, there's a rumor that you used to dine regularly with P.T. Barnum. Is that is any yet? Yeah, no, somebody told me that wasn't true, was it?
Well, we used to sit right outside the marina, which is across from Seaside Park. It was Barnum's last home.
Yeah.
Until the University of Bridgeport tore it down for a student cafeteria.
Yeah.
And P.T. was very upset, but I told him, "Hey, listen. Yeah, you got a beautiful park to walk in. You can't have it all, you know?"
And now, was this before or after you would have lunch with Jasper McCleavy, or is that a little before your time?
Oh, that was way after, as a matter of fact. Jasper and I used to go to the corner eatery, and he'd always tip with a quarter, you know?
Yeah. Chris, hope all is well. What has caught your eye over the past few days here, either locally in Bridgeport or anything statewide? What do you see and hear that raised your eyebrows?
Well, you know, Paul, I'm still very excited about the State Board of Education being involved in the Bridgeport education system.
Mm-hmm.
2 days ago, they had a meeting in Hartford, and they gave a report on Bridgeport, the audit, and what they're doing with hiring teachers and also the school bus contracts. And what I was most proud of is that the three people that are on the technical team working in Bridgeport said that the Bridgeport community has been very welcoming, hospitable. The city has opened its arms to their advice, and it's working. As a matter of fact, they were able to hire, I think originally it was 120 vacancies for special ed teachers. It got down to 40, and now they only have two more to fill.
Wow.
So that intervention, setting up the guardrails, if you will, for the system is only going to be beneficial for Bridgeport. And I was just happy to hear the report. Learned a lot of things that, you know, the Board of Ed doesn't vote on budgets, believe it or not.
Mm.
And that's got to be changed. And the state came up with like 34 items on a checklist, and the city's implementing it. So very excited about that. Of course, there's some critics who say, well, when is the state going to give us money? And I think the approach they're taking is right. You set up the guardrails, make sure if money is given to the school system, it's used wisely and properly. And I think that will be the next step. But I'm just buoyed by the fact that the Board of Education, the education system, is getting the attention it needs. And I really have high hopes for it. I was very impressed with the report that they gave.
Couple more minutes here with our buddy Chris Caruso with his weekly wrap-up. A story earlier in the week, a judge canceling a Bridgeport City Council Democratic primary over questionable petitions. I don't want to get into the meat and potatoes of this case in particular, but Chris, obviously you've seen this for years, and petition signatures and the process here. So, Chris, when a judge looks at petition signatures or election officials look at, what and we're not necessarily asking you about this case here, but what might tip them off, Chris, in your years of seeing this? When does a judge or an opposing campaign go, hey, we don't think these are legitimate or proper, and what's the recourse there? How does this thing work?
Well, you know, usually you could go to the State Elections Enforcement Commission, but their turnaround time is very long, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And so when you're in the middle of a primary, you have very short amount of time in order to get names on the ballot so the voters can vote. And in this particular case, the two candidates that are incumbents decided to bring the case and the lawsuit to the Superior Court. And, you know, what was discovered, there were discrepancies. For example, names were crossed out. People had signed the petition, mm-hmm. and their names were crossed out. Some people appeared, did not appear, I should say, in front of the person who was getting the signature. So when I go to a door, I knock on the door, a person comes, I've got to know who the person is or ask for identification. So that wasn't being done. So there was a question of that. And what the judge finally ruled, there weren't enough signatures, even with the discrepancies, to allow the person to run for office. So the judge, I think it was Judge Thompson, disqualified it. And so those two challenge candidates were not permitted to run in the primary. And so now the two incumbents have no primary in September, and they go on to the general election in November.
And Chris, isn't this the reason why, and I've heard this for years, I've never had a petition or worked on a campaign with a petition, but isn't this why, for example, if somebody said, well, sir, you need 200 signatures, verifiable signatures to get on the ballot, your team will say get 300 or get 400, right? Is that the general rule?
That's right, Paul. And you find that with more experienced campaign people that have been involved in the system and understand it.
Yeah.
You never go in with the exact number you want. Because, you know, it's bound to happen. Some names are going to be disqualified. For example, a person signs, but they're not on the voting list. They're not a citizen. You know, a lot of people, for example, they go to supermarkets and ask people, are you a Democrat? And the guy says, yeah, I'm a Democrat. Okay, sign here. And then when you take it into the registrar's office to review, you find out they're not even registered to vote, and some don't live in the town. So it's methodical, but you have to have an understanding.
And the guy probably says, well, you didn't ask me that.
Exactly right. And try to find that person again. You'll never find them because you have to stand out in front of the supermarket. So it's better, a very methodical door-to-door campaign. At the end of each evening, you go over the names, you match them up to the voting list. So when you turn them into the registrar's office, there's accuracy to it. The other thing is that when a person notarizes the circular to the person who's going out getting the signatures, that notary has to know the individual.
And
if they don't, well, because, you know, there's a part in there, so-and-so appeared before me on such a date. And so you have to be able, and sometime a notary signs it, and the individual actually didn't go and circulate it. They gave it to their mother or their brother. So and then they signed their name to it. So there's a lot of things that it has to be done properly. And in this case, I think the judge was right. She dismissed it. And based on there weren't enough signatures. But, you know, Paul, fundamentally, you're absolutely right. If you need 300, you better get 400. You just better be safe. That's just common sense, you know?
Chris, finally, another big story here. And again, not for the particulars of this story, but just the mechanics here. This big story, and we've been covering it here in the station, this really passionate disagreement about these big monopoles for UI, north of the railroad tracks, south of the tracks, and the siding council changing their votes. Chris, this is so difficult because you're dealing with, whether it's the Siding Council or PURA, you have these unelected people who, granted, are appointed by elected people. But it seems to me, Chris, that this is the kind of thing. Now, listen, it's like a baseball umpire, right? 50% of the time, 50% of the people are going to be mad at you. But I can imagine what the pressure is on these people who were appointed by somebody elected and probably have people tugging at them in both directions, whether it's a Siding Council or PURA or somebody like that.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, Paul, I think it's incumbent upon those commissioners. They take an oath to uphold the laws and the regulations of the state of Connecticut. Mm-hmm. They have to uphold them.
Yeah.
And if they find that there's a deficiency or a problem, they can vote against the utility company. You know, I think Bridgeport Fairfield has suggested that they put the wires underground.
Yeah.
And in all honesty, it does cost more money, but probably the best thing to do. You know, you're looking at the climate change, the weather conditions we've had. You know, you see poles snapping in the middle of a storm.
Yeah.
You know, the telephone poles, right? They should be underground. But I think what puts in doubt this whole decision by the Siding Council is in June, they denied the utility company.
Well, yeah.
And then like a couple of months later, they approved it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the question. How is that to be? You know, isn't there a period of time when the utility company could come back with a new application? And I think that's what upsets people. You know, they put time and money, they hire attorneys, and then this goes on.
And I think
that's what it's upsetting.
Yeah, and Chris, human nature is going to be, you know how human nature is. You start talking about this at the coffee shop, and somebody says, well, somebody got to them.
The fix is in, right?
Yeah, right.
No, you're right, Paul, 100%.
Yeah. Chris Caruso. Chris, thank you, sir. Have a wonderful weekend. Take care of yourself,
you
and
too.
We'll chat next week. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it. And as I like to do, wrapping up a week, especially in this sort of break, heading into the weekend, we've cried and bitched and moaned about everything under the sun news-wise, so let's enjoy a chat with an author. I love doing this. I marvel at people that can write music and write books, neither of which I can do. I just flap my gums here for 4 hours a day. And heading into the weekend, maybe you want to download a book, a good audio book, or order it in print. Here's one that caught my eye. The name of the book, now get this, is Tales of Militant Chemistry, The Film Factory in a Century of War. And yes, our guest, Alice Lovejoy, connects. And I never knew about this. There is a connection, she says, between film, as in, the film you and I used to use, and war, and armaments, and chemicals. Alice Lovejoy is a former editor at Film Comment. She's a professor of film and media studies at the University of Minnesota. Alice, hi, it's Paul here in Connecticut. Good evening. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. It's great to be here.
Boy, I read the premise of this, Alice, and I'm like, huh? What? And you're talking to a guy here. I was really into photography young. So, I mean, the film companies to me were like, wow, look at this. I bought this film and that film, and what an amazing company. But what you contend in this book is pretty wild. Tell my listeners about this.
Yeah, so this book takes companies that most of us are really familiar with, companies like Eastman Kodak in the United States, like the Agfa company in Germany, companies that we really, as you just said, as we really associate with film, with movies, with photography, you know, the cameras you might have had in your house up until pretty recently. And it looks at them in an entirely different way as chemical companies, as companies that made things like plastics and dyes and pharmaceuticals and weapons. And this is, as you said, this is really at the heart of the book, the story of how these film manufacturers throughout the 20th century were involved in military production because they were chemical companies. And in Kodak's case, the largest example of this was its work for the Manhattan Project at Oak Ridge, where it separated uranium.
So there was so detail that connection again. So there was a connection between Eastman Kodak, a Kodak moment, right? There was a connection between them and the Manhattan Project that produced the nuclear bombs.
That's right. Yeah. The Tennessee Eastman Corporation, which was Eastman Kodak's largest chemical subsidiary for most of the 20th century, operated the Y-12 uranium separation plant at Oak Ridge, which processed the uranium that was used in the bomb dropped on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945.
Yeah, now you mentioned other, and you mentioned AGVA. I didn't buy that much AGVA film, but I used AGVA photographic paper, my God, when I had my enlargers. What is there? What is AGVA's involvement here, Alice?
Yes, so AGVA was, during World War II and before it, it was part of the IG Farben chemical cartel, which your listeners probably know about, really notorious cartel in the history of Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. And AGVA's work for the military started even before then. It was involved with bottling poison gas during World War I. And during World War II, it was involved in making rayon for the Nazi government and also making film.
How did you get this information? In other words, was this information, Alice, always out there and people were just kind of looking away? Or did you have to dig for this? And do these companies admit this now? Are they saying, hey, it was a bad time, we've moved past this? Talk a little about that.
You know, I think when we think back to World War II and especially the Manhattan Project, we have to remember how many private companies were involved in this military research and development and how important it was seen for ending the war. It seemed to be for ending the war. And so this is something that was discussed in shareholder reports after the war. It's something that is in the big histories of the Manhattan Project, but it's a connection. The connection back to the film work is something that that hasn't really been discussed before. And one of the things that I show in my book is just how much the chemical components of film were related to the chemistry of war.
Tales of Militant Chemistry, The Film Factory in a Century of War. A few more minutes here with Alice Lovejoy. So, Alice, you talk about the chemical components here. Now, at companies like AGVA and Kodak, did the workers know what was going on here? Were these overlapping jobs they have, or was in what you've been able to find, were they segregated jobs, different parts of these companies? Did a lot of them, were they doing things they didn't realize what was going on? What was the lowdown on that?
Yeah, and I think it's different with different factories and different companies. But in the case of Kodak, you do have a lot of people moving between factories. So people who had spent a lot of their careers working on film chemistry were moved down to work on the chemistry of the atomic bomb and the physics of the atomic bomb. And so there is a certain amount of basic scientific knowledge that goes into this. So people, some people certainly knew, some certainly knew what they were doing, but it was a highly secretive endeavor. And a lot of the workers at these factories for the Manhattan Project, of course, as we know well, did not know what they were making because it was so secret.
Are there still people who to this day, and they would have to be very old, I would imagine, just doing the math, are there people to this day who are still talking about it, who would be well into, I guess, their 80s and 90s here? Were you able to find any source material from those sorts of folks?
There are some wonderful interviews that have been collected and oral histories that have been done with former workers at the Manhattan Project and also oral histories of some of the workers at the AGVA plant, the film plant in the eastern part of Germany that I was able to find, which, you know, in that case, really poignant, really sad stories about the forced laborers from Eastern Europe who were forced to work in the film factory there.
Finally, Alice, any lasting effects on these people? I mean, even today when you're working with chemicals, quote unquote, I'm doing air quotes now, in a lot of people's minds, it's, oh boy, that's dangerous stuff. And we're still helping people today with present day chemical sort of work. Was it dangerous back then? What was the level of danger they were dealing with?
Yeah, and I think the AGVA plant is a good example of this. Some of the women, many of the women who worked in that plant left with permanent injuries to their lungs from the really damaging fumes from the chemicals they were working with to make film and to make rayon. And they carried this with them for the rest of their lives if they were lucky enough to survive that work in, again, the German factories of AGVA.
And final question, forgive me if you don't know this because it just popped in my mind. Is there any documentation, Alice, or evidence that the commercial grade film that even was available, these are legendary companies, they've been making film for decades, was any of that film hazardous to the average consumer? Do we know that, or is that a definite no? What about that?
That's a great question, and I can answer part of it, mm-hmm. which is that, you know, early on in film's history, for motion pictures, film was made on something called cellulose nitrate, which is nitrocellulose, and extremely flammable and extremely dangerous. So there were histories of, you know, public safety questions around film that go back very, very early in its history, especially with motion pictures. And some of that's carried along. But as for the users of film with a still camera, I don't know too much about that.
Wow. This is great stuff, great work here. And as a guy who I said used to shoot film over and over again, I am startled by this, folks. Pick it up. Tales of Militant Chemistry, The Film Factory in a Century of War. Alice Lovejoy, the author. Alice, thank you. This is fascinating. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's been great to speak with you.
Appreciate it. Alice Lovejoy, L-O-V-E-J-O-Y. I'm looking at it on Amazon, so you can download it there or get the hard copy or whatever. I think there's an audiobook. I'm not sure. Tales of Militant Chemistry, The Film Factory in a Century of War, and how these film factories, mainly for a lot of us, Kodak, growing up, I used Kodak film and Agfa paper.